Welcome to the International Schools Podcast, where we discuss all aspects of technology and life in international schools, with new episodes live every 2 weeks. This podcast is sponsored by Apps Events. We're a Google for Education partner and active since the launch of Google Apps for Education in 2006. We're a team of former educators and all experts in helping schools integrate Google into their schools and their classrooms. All training is customized for each school, and we make sure it has a lasting impact. Literally thousands of educators worldwide have earned their Google Educator certification with us, with our certification boot camps, and these take place every month and get your staff certified quickly. We also host Google Summits, which are fun, two-day conference-style events with concurrent sessions and keynotes delivered by experienced Google trainers, teaching on a broad range of topics using G Suite both in the classroom and in the school. Check it out over at appsevents.com, and we can bring any of these events to your school, which is an amazing way to build a Google community amongst your staff to support each other, plus to increase the profile of yourself and your school. The podcast is also brought to you by Acer for Education. People ask us what Chromebooks we recommend for schools, and after trying them all, quite literally, we always recommend Acer. We've been to Acer headquarters in Taiwan to be part of product discussions, and they're genuinely the best thought out, most cost-effective, and most importantly, durable devices out there. They're always innovating, including the first tablet running Chrome and the first convertible touchscreen Chromebook. The latest version of this is a Spin 11, which has a stylus and two cameras, and we highly, highly recommend it for schools. They, of course, have a full range of Windows laptops, and for esports fans, their Predator range is second to none. If you'd like more information, please just leave your email over at gg.gg/Acer Education. That's gg.gg/Acer Education, and we'll get right back to you. And now, on to the interview. Hello, and welcome to the International Schools Podcast. Today, I'm back in Europe. I think I mentioned I've been away for 2 months in Asia, and I'm delighted to be talking to Will Henry, who's from the US, but works for an international school in Shanghai, China. So it's really interesting. Will actually contacted me. He'd listened to the podcast. And for me, it's interesting because Will has done what a lot of people want to do and transitioned from being an English teacher, like an ESL, you know, English as a second language teacher working for language schools, and transition to working for an international school, which is a really interesting thing. And I want to talk about the ways people could do that. So Will, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dan. Happy to be here.
Cool. Will, so let's get into your background. Like, how did it all start? I know you worked in Taiwan, but what were you doing before that? Like, what did you do after school?
Before I was in Taiwan, I was in a university, and I had, you know, really no ambition of becoming a teacher. I was just finishing up my pre-med undergrad back in the States. Basically, all that meant was I was taking a bunch of science classes and preparing the prerequisites to go on to medical school. Kind of towards the end of my undergrad, I started having the feeling that maybe it wasn't what I wanted to do. I decided to take a year off, teach. I didn't know where I wanted to go. I remember at the beginning, I was looking into Latin America. Yep. Then I found out just how much college debt I had. So I decided I need to go somewhere to make a bit more money.
On that topic, I mean, that's something we've discussed a bit on the podcast before. It's, I think, what is the average student debt someone comes out with in the U.S. now? Is it like $30,000 or higher than that?
Yeah, so I think about the time I was graduating, it was around 30, and that's like about how much I had. So when you're, you know, 21 years old, that seems like a really, really big number, and it still seems like a big number. So
it's crazy because, I mean, Americans I know all say that. I mean, You get on campus and you immediately get all these credit card companies like harassing you and targeting you, doing promotions on campus, trying to get you to sign up and all these things. You know, and everyone kind of jumps into it.
Fortunately, I avoided any of those, but I just the tuition in my school put me in a position where I had enough to pay off that I didn't feel like I could really take a year off and have like a vacation or something like that. I needed to at least be able to support myself and send some money home while I was doing it.
Sure. So you looked into being an English teacher. What made you get into that? Because it's something that I never did. I almost did it, actually, but a lot of my friends did. And how did you come to sort of think about this as a... Because it's kind of like, for example, I live in Prague, and it's almost like the entry-level job. People come to Prague to work as an English teacher. You know, a lot of people get into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Taiwan is definitely the entry level job. There's so many English teachers there. I think, you know, I knew a couple of people that had taught overseas. One at a proper international school at Lincoln in Argentina. Another friend who had done the JET program, which is another way to get into ESL teaching, like language centers and high schools around Japan. And so I knew this option was available. And so, yeah, I started looking. I found lots of websites like Teaching Nomad, I think is the name of it. I can't quite remember. But lots of these different agencies that would advertise jobs.
Sure.
So I got an idea for what the market was like and where different locations I could teach at.
And how did you come to pick Taiwan? Like, did you see some jobs advertised there?
Yeah, I kept seeing a lot of jobs advertised there. And to be honest, I had no interest in Asia at the time. I think it's a shame that like a lot of Americans kind of grow up with the being kind of focused on the Americas, like Mexico, yep. Central America, South America. That's where I was interested in. But then I kept seeing jobs posted for Taiwan and China. I just started reading about Taiwan, and I'll be honest, once I had read more about Taiwan, I found a job in Costa Rica. It seemed like it was going to work, but by that point, I was already pretty interested in the Chinese language, Taiwan as an island and culture to visit, and I decided to go.
Yeah, I mean, just to stop here, Taiwan's one of my favorite places in Asia. I've got some good friends there. And it's interesting, because a lot of people don't know much about it. I mean, Taiwan is actually... The name of Taiwan is Republic of China, and Taiwanese people consider that Taiwan is the real China, you know, because it was when the communists took over, the leaders, the nationalists went to the island of Taiwan, which is an island. So it actually is very Chinese, you know. They speak Mandarin, and people are like, but it's way way friendlier than China. That's what's strange. I don't know why. I don't know if you have that experience, but my experience is Taiwan is like. It's super friendly, and China can be friendly as well, but not universally, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know, you know, what led to that, but yeah, walking around Taiwan, I mean, it's like it's not quite the same as Thailand with people smiling, and but it's pretty close. And I just remember my first couple of months there, I was lost all the time. I couldn't read Chinese, but you know, people would invite me onto the back of their scooter and drive me to where I wanted to go, or it's the hospitality there and welcoming culture. It was really nice as a place for me to first land.
Right. So how did it work? Like you got a job from the U.S. and you went across with a job already agreed?
Yeah. So there were a couple of different ways of doing it at that time. This was about 7 years ago, I guess. So I read about people who kind of just flew to Taiwan without a job and scored one by just like walking around to different language schools. And there are also people that, you know, you could find a job before you went and maybe have a little bit less pay, but at least you were secured and knowing that you had a visa and everything was taken care of for you. And I think when I was 21, it was my first time living overseas. I decided to be a little bit more conservative and look for a job. And yeah, I interviewed over Skype. And I wrote an application letter, and at the time I applied for, it was the biggest kind of language center in Taiwan, HESS. I think there's probably still the biggest one there. It's like very similar to EF, which is mostly in China. I'm not sure exactly where else EF is, but it's just the giant, HESS is a giant language school that stretches across the island, and I believe a little bit in China now.
Right. Right. So you turned up with a job, and how did it all go? I mean... So obviously you went to Taichung, which is also a city I like a lot, the second biggest city in Taiwan, I believe. So you just turned up and they had everything organized, accommodation and things, or how did it work?
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny. I mean, you land and they have like a central kind of office in Taipei, and you have you arrive. I think my cohort had about 40 to 60 other vagabond teachers or ex-business people or people, recent grads arriving. And it's really interesting because you meet all these people with – the only thing you have in common is that you kind of took a chance and came overseas. And we did like a week of training, did some demo lessons, and then, yeah, they you get position your posting of where you're going to go and teach. Everyone wants Taipei, but a lot of people get sent elsewhere. And yeah, I was one of those other people. I was sent to Taichung. But I was really happy with the city.
Now, it's probably a good time to say, like, I don't have much knowledge. Like, what are the different qualifications for ESL teachers? Like, and how does it work? Because I know definitely some people have done it with no qualification. So what are the different ways of doing this, and what are the certifications you can get?
Sure. I mean, overwhelmingly, every country is going to require you to have a bachelor's degree for visa reasons. Beyond that, it varies from just that to wanting you to have some sort of like TEFL certification or just a CELTA some countries require. Taiwan, at the time, I think they've increased the requirements of visa recently. I can't speak too much on that now, the current situation. But I just had a bachelor's degree, and that's all that they required. My bachelor's degree was in English, like English lit. But to be honest, you know, teaching English as a second language in Taiwan, I didn't really use my degree so much. It was mainly kind of just learning by them giving you a book and you trying to figure out how to manage a classroom and how to teach content.
Sure. So did you do like a TEFL certificate, all of these certificates?
Yeah, I didn't. So the HESS at the time, I'm pretty sure they still do this, where they will actually award you a TEFL certification by the end of your first year teaching, like monthly trainings to get you to speed. But they put you in the classroom straight away without a ton of
So how much work, like, I'm just, if somebody wanted, listening to this, wanted to do this, like, I know there's a bunch of full-time courses. Is it like a couple of weeks full-time, or how sort of long is it if you did a full-time course for TEFL?
I think it varies. You know, I didn't take one myself, but I had friends who did, and there's a whole range of them. There's like a 300-hour ones. There's ones that I think like 40 hours. In different countries, we'll have a different requirement. Some will say that you need to have a more strict and lengthy certification. And some, like I said, like Taiwan, actually, they don't even require that. So you just have to look into the country you want to go to and see what they require. A lot of these sites that will post jobs have sections on the site which will explain country by country exactly what the requirements are.
Sure. So what was life like as a language teacher? I mean, first, did they sort you some accommodation out? Did you have like a shared apartment, or how did it all work?
Yeah, so when I arrived in Taichung, the school that showed me different apartments, I had to pay for my own housing. And I'm pretty sure that that's how most language schools will do it in Taiwan. I got paid enough money that I was able to find decent housing. For me at the time, as a 21-year-old, 22-year-old, just out of college, it was satisfactory. And I mean, outside of that, I was on my own. No one else in Taichung spoke English really, except for other teachers. And so it definitely required me to go out and kind of find my own fun and find my own friends and try to build a community to interact a social life.
Yeah, I noticed Taichung. I mean, there's definitely expats there, but it's not like Taipei, where it's a much bigger scene. I mean, you know, it's much more mixed in with local scene there.
Yeah, my second year, I moved from Taichung to a different school in Taipei, and it's completely different. It was not hard to find social groups to hang out with, whether it's playing soccer or if you want to study Chinese, playing basketball. You can find people who are interested in it because it's such a big expat population in Taipei.
So what's the work like in these language schools? I mean, how many hours would you teach typically in a week? Well, and what's kind of the range people teach?
Yeah, so like student contact time was about anywhere from 16 to 25 hours, depending upon the time of the year. I had friends I know who taught up closer to 30 contact hours a week.
Yeah, that's quite a lot.
And you know, when you first land and you first start teaching, it'll probably 1 hour of teacher contact time for like 1 hour of prep time, or maybe a half an hour of prep time, because you don't know what you're doing usually, unless you're a gifted teacher straight off the bat. And I certainly wasn't. But by the end of the first year, it had gotten down. You kind of do in language schools, you kind of use the same routine at most classes. And so by the end, I was able to look at the book and spend about 15 minutes to figure out, you know, what activities I was going to do and how I was going to run my class. It's quite different than how you would run a classroom at an international school. But still, there is a lot of crossover of skills that prepared me, I think, for my next steps.
Yeah, so because that's definitely something I want to get into is, transitioning from being an English teacher to an international school teacher. Mm-hmm. And So what when did you start to think that you wanted to do something different? Did you decide straight away from Taiwan you wanted to go and become a teacher? How'd you met people from international schools and seen kind of the lifestyle they had?
Yeah, that's actually exactly it. I was I think I was playing pool on a Friday night, and a crew came in from Taipei American School, and I started talking to them. And I'd been feeling a little bit dissatisfied with my job in Taiwan. You know, the kids were great. It was pretty easy, but you know, like the conversations that were happening in the faculty room weren't about teaching, and I didn't feel like always my colleagues wanted to talk about best practices or figure out how we could really be better at what we're doing, which was fine. You know, I enjoyed like the kind of the feeling of just, you know, being on vacation, but I wanted something a little bit more. And I was talking to these teachers from Taipei American School, and I was like, wow, this is exactly, you know, the type of conversations I want to be having in my work. So what I did is I went on to a couple of international schools around Taiwan, around Asia, and I clicked through their faculty pages just to kind of figure out like what backgrounds these teachers had that let them get into this field and find these jobs. And so I kind of found the next steps that I was going to have to take to teach at an international school. And I found there were a couple choices I had in front of me, but what I decided on was to go back to the States to do a program that would put me into a U.S. classroom for 2 years, get me certified, and really cover the bases that I needed to do to get into international teaching.
What did you say? You mentioned the options. What do you say the options were to get you through a job at international school apart from, you know, going and doing your teaching certification in the U.S.?
Yeah, so I know there's a program called Teach Ready, and I think Teach Now, and they're set up for people that are living overseas. They wanted to get a teaching certificate in the U.S. and there are a few thousand. I think they run between $3,000 and $6,000 U.S. dollars, which I think was a bit pricey for me at the time. And plus, I wanted to get some actual experience teaching in the U.S. But for other people, that's probably a really good option. And then,
And there's also an option. Some people do a PGCEI, which is, you know, if there's a few of these around, it doesn't actually get you a teaching certification, but some international schools will kind of accept that. You know, I mean, generally not the higher tier ones, but definitely is a way to get into schools that can work as well.
Yeah. So I've had friends who did that, and then while if you do like Teach Now or Teach Ready, you won't have the 2 years of experience, which a lot of schools and a lot of countries have as a visa requirement. There are plenty of schools around the world, you know, new, and they're just looking to get people into the classrooms to teach. Yep. And you can get a couple years there, and then you can transition into you know, a more stable or a higher tier school afterwards.
So Teach Now and Teach Ready, how many hours or months of teaching do you do as part of a program? So you basically get a job with a local school, and then the U.S. whatever state, I think, is it Florida or something, they certify you for those hours you've taught in those schools.
Yeah, I think for most of them, people will. My friends who've done it, they've got like an internship at a school while they're doing it. So I had a friend in Taiwan; she was teaching for Hess, and then there's an international school called Kangchao International School, and I think that she had gone over and done some sort of like a student teaching type situation while she was doing it, in the hopes that she could go on and get all the data. And I think that a lot of times they'll have you collect, you know, lesson plans and data from your students to help support your portfolio.
Sure. So what was the program you did? It was basically you go to teach in an inner city school, and they cover the cost of your teaching certification. Is that how it works?
Yeah, I'll be honest. It was pretty wild. So some of the listeners might know about Teach for America. So I did a sister program, a really similar program called the New Teacher Project, TNTP. And so I basically got placed. After an application interview, I got placed in an inner city urban school in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yep.
And I taught primary school there, and I actually taught ESL, but I was teaching in an actual classroom. I was co-teaching with classroom teachers, homeroom teachers in Charlotte. Yeah, man, it was an incredible experience.
Because Taiwan is kind of at the other end of a spectrum in terms of well-behaved students. It must have been pretty wild.
Oh, I mean, we had you aren't guaranteed a position while you're doing the training. So my second day of school, I was being observed, and there was actually like a gun found on campus.
in a primary school.
The training program, I was put in a ninth grade English classroom, And I just remember knowing that I was going to be observed that day, and then hearing that there had been like gunshots next to the buses. But fortunately, that was the only time I had to deal with a situation like that.
Right.
But even in the primary school, I mean, we had 5 or 6 lockdowns a year, it seemed like, with helicopters flying over. It was not a normal American school.
Sure.
But that's why they put me in the school. So I remember just thinking like, wow, this is going to be amazing for my behavior management. And I think it was. It really had me practice some skills that, you know, I didn't actually have a lot of chances to practice when I was in Taiwan.
Sure. So did you go into this thinking, like how long was the time commitment? Did you go into it thinking, okay, this will take 2 years, and then I'll be returning to an international school? What was this kind of time to get the certification then?
Yeah, so you have to do 1 year. Other programs like Teach for America will require you to do 2, and then they award you a teaching certificate, and then they give you a scholarship to study at a university to do your master's degree. And so I decided to stay for 2 because, to be honest, I think going to a school and just teaching for 1 year, there's not enough of a chance to really get to know how things work. The first year, the first 6 months, you're figuring out how things work.
Sure.
Yeah. So, I taught for 2 years, and, I think that was the plan from the beginning, but I knew that this was always for getting the experience to come back overseas. Cause, I'd really enjoyed living overseas, and, I just wanted to find a way that I could kind of make a career out of it while teaching.
A lot of people have similar situations, you know. It's for sure. I think once you learn about international schools, you realize it's a great, for certain people, it's a great opportunity, you know, because you can you can do 3 to 4 years in one country, then maybe you want to go to Africa, or maybe you want to go, you know, to Europe, you know, and you can really see a bit of the world as well.
Sure. And another thing that I love about it is, you know, you can take on roles of responsibility so much faster in international education. You know, if I was teaching in the U.S., if I wanted to take on a role like, so this year I'm an instructional coach in my school, I might have to teach for 10, 15 years in the States, or wait for someone to retire to move on to a role where I could push myself a little bit harder.
Yeah.
But in international education, just by the definition of how it works with people going from school to school, people living overseas, they want to go back home. Positions open up and you can quickly gain experience in areas that you might have to wait almost half your career to gain experience in back in the States.
Sure. So you went to China. Now, China is the number of international schools is, I've heard different, I don't know if you know how many there are. I mean, I've heard it's maybe even in the thousands at this point, I think, but it's a huge growing market, and a lot of teachers are going there, and that's where you ended up going.
Yeah, you know, I didn't have my sights on China per se, but just, it was I think just probability was that I was going to end up here. I think I signed up to Search Associates, and I interviewed at about 15 or 16 different schools. Most of them were in China.
Did you go to the Search Associates, their career fair, or did you just have online interviews by Skype?
Yeah, so I had plans to go to the Boston Fair in Cambridge, but I actually found a job before the fair. So
right.
I would love to have the experience to go to the fair at some point. It sounds like it's a pretty interesting and lively environment. Yeah, but yeah, I did Skype interviews, and I found the school I'm currently working at, YK Pow, which is it's a bilingual school in downtown Shanghai. I got a good vibe from the interviewers. I talked to them a bit about the curriculum and their plans for the direction of the school. And I decided to come to Shanghai.
And what is it, how many foreigners are working there as teachers or in school?
Yeah, so it's 3 campuses. It's a primary school, a middle school, and a high school. And so I don't know the total numbers because they're in different parts of the city. I can only speak for the primary school, but I think we have about 60 international teachers here.
Wow, it's a lot. It's a big school.
Yeah, we have about 600 students. And so, I think if you count passports, it's like about 60-40 in terms of Chinese to international students.
Yep.
When you're in a classroom, it feels a bit more like probably 80-20 because we have a lot of kids who have passports from Taiwan or Hong Kong or maybe the U.S. or England, but their parents are Chinese speakers. So from a language and linguistic point of view, it's about 80-20.
Right, got it. And we've talked a bit about Shanghai in the podcast. Like, what's your experience been of it? I've never been. I've got to go next year. I really want to visit, actually, but it's been on my list for a while. But I mean, all I hear is how it's growing at a crazy rate. You know, you go back a year later and you don't even recognize the city sometimes.
Yeah, they have like a really pretty famous before and after photo taken in like 1990 and then 2000, 10, and it's you can't even recognize the city. I love it here. You know, before I came, I had spent time in Beijing just on a traveling in between Taiwan on a flight back, and I expected Shanghai to be like Beijing. But I'll be honest, Shanghai, while it's certainly not like Taipei, it's actually more similar to Taipei, I feel like, than it is to Beijing. And yeah, it's very international feeling. The school is in Jing'an, which is the central district of Shanghai, and it's bordering on the French Concession, which is a really lovely part of the city that has a bit of a European.
Is that the old kind of original colonial buildings and stuff? Which part of Shanghai is that?
Yeah, exactly. There's some older buildings there. It kind of feels like a Paris and China were like merged together. Wider streets, kind of overhanging trees, coffee shops, bread shops. I think in the past it was where the French Concession, where lot of French business took place. The French embassy is down there. It's really beautiful.
What's it? So you became an instructional coach. This is quite interesting. I mean, like tech coaches, it's an interesting role. Like, just for people listening, like what kind of things do you do? I mean, are you essentially training teachers and staff on using technology and coaching them on how to use technology in their classroom better?
Yeah, so that would be a tech coach. What I do is more has to do with delivery of instruction or classroom management, things like that. So I'm not really training so much. What happens is that I think every school runs it differently. It's a new position in education, really. It's been popping up over the past five or six years. So if a teacher wants to try something in their classroom, try something they haven't done before, what they'll do is they can come to me, and they know that I can come into their classroom and I'm not going to be judging them or telling administration if something doesn't go right. And it's someone who I can go and they can bounce ideas off of me. We can try it in their classroom together, whether it's technology or if it's a new form of formative assessment, or maybe they have a classroom management issue, and they can try it, and we can try it together in their classroom. Or if they want, they can come in, they can try it in my classroom with me teaching. I guess it's just like a safe space for teachers to be experimental and try new things with their teaching, which a lot of times, I don't think happens a lot in teaching. People kind of stay siloed in their own classrooms. There's not as much collaboration as there could be.
No, I think it's a great idea, and that's your full time role now, is it?
No, it's actually just in addition to.
So you work as a teacher, and then this is okay, great. That's probably good for you, keeping you grounded in the classroom as well.
Yeah. Also, it gives the option for people coming into my classroom and seeing me try something or trying it with me in my classroom. Otherwise, I would always be pushing into other people's classroom, which gives teachers the feeling of being observed or some other appraisal systems and things like that.
Definitely. So yeah, finally, what's it like socially in Shanghai? Do you tend to hang out mostly people from your school, and is there like what's it like in terms of to experience it there?
Yeah, so a lot of the teachers at my school, I think, will hang out with each other or some other international schools around the city. I've been trying to improve my Chinese, and I also have a couple other hobbies, like I do some swing dancing, I play soccer, which will. When I do those things, I tend to hang out with mostly Chinese people.
Yeah.
So I say that depends, which crowd I'm running with. I don't think the two crowds kind of intermingle too much. It's such a big city that it depends which activity you're doing, what your interests are. But I hang out with both.
Yeah. I mean, have you set yourself a target to actually learn Mandarin Chinese fluently? Do you think it's doable for you?
It's certainly doable for me. The problem is I'm doing a master's degree right now, which is kind of cut into my my Chinese study. My master's, I'm doing it in education, so not Chinese related. But I find over the summers I'm able to study, but I try to study a little bit every week. My goal is not to be fluent, even though I think I probably could be in a few years. We'll see. My goal right now is just they have the HSK test, which is a test that can give you your level of Chinese proficiency. It's something you can put on your resume if you're looking for a job where you would be speaking Chinese. It's not really what I'm interested in. I just find it interesting. I'm shooting for an HSK, doing my HSK 4 in a couple of months, which would put me at a mid to high intermediate range.
It's good to have someone. I think I'm kind of similar in a if doing something like that is good, it's just good to have a target. Say, like, I can get this, because, you know, I work well better when I've got something to aim for, you know. So that's kind of, I think, a good way to do it.
Yeah, I had this kind of false, like, a preconception about learning language before I went to Taiwan. There was just, I was going to land, and through osmosis, I was just going to pick up Chinese. I think enough people told me that when I was, that's how language learning worked when I was younger, that's sure. how I expected it to work. And it's really not the case, at least not for Chinese. You have to explicitly go after and intentionally try to learn it, or else it's not going to happen. I know so many people that have been here for 10 years and, you know, they can barely count to 10, which would, you know, depress me if that was the case I was in. But I think leaving China, if I was at HSK 4 or 5, at least I'd feel like my time was well spent.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, often international schools are the worst places for learning languages. I know plenty of people who've worked for international schools who never learn anything of a local language, you know, because you're kind of in a bit of a bubble.
And I don't think Shanghai is the best city in China either. If I was in Chengdu or Beijing or one of the kind of, not that those are small cities, but they're a little bit less international in some respects. But maybe if I was also in a tier two city, I would probably have a better chance of really practicing my Chinese. But
sure.
Happy here.
Great. Look, Will, I think that's about the end of our chat. I want to thank you for coming on. It's been super interesting, and I hope people are going to find this valuable. So thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
Yeah. Anything you want to promote? Any blog or anything? Anything you're up to that you want to promote online?
No, I don't have any projects online right now. But I look forward to the next episodes dropping, and keep up the good work with the podcast.
Sounds good, Will. Thank you very much.